Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. Dr. Stephen Meyer, the director of the Center for Science and Culture and one of the founders of the Intelligent Design Movement, was recently invited to speak at a Socrates in the City event in Washington, D.C., and discuss the question, is there a controversy about the theory or theories of evolution, and if so, why does that matter? In the course of his discussion, Dr. Meyer explained that his book, Signature in the Cell, dealt with the first branch of evolutionary theory, the chemical evolutionary theory, which seeks to tackle the explanation for the origin of life. He concluded that the theory failed to produce or explain the information required to create life. And while Signature in the Cell did not address the second branch of evolutionary theory, it didn't stop his critics from criticizing him as though it had. This criticism inspired him to take a look at this second branch, the neo-Darwinist branch, dealing with biological evolutionary theory that seeks to explain how new forms of life evolved from simpler pre-existing forms and became the subject of his upcoming book. Dr. Meyer gave the audience a preview of his follow-up to Signature in the Cell. With special thanks to Eric Metaxas and SocratesInTheCity.com, we are able to share with you excerpts from this event, which include Dr. Meyer's sneak peek at the subject of his upcoming book.
I want to ask the question about Darwinian evolution, the modern form, neo-Darwinism. Can this mechanism of mutation and natural selection generate enough information to build fundamentally new forms of life? I used to ask my students a question. If you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? Ask you too, but you shouldn't do that to non-students, okay? You need code, right? Software, code, information. It turns out the same thing is true in life. Just as we needed information to build that very first cell, we also need new information to build new cell types and new forms of life. Every new form of life that arises in the history of life requires new information. So can the mutation and selection mechanism of Darwinism produce that new information? This is the topic of my next book. The topic is something called the Cambrian Explosion. And the Cambrian Explosion is the geologically sudden appearance of most of the major animal designs, or what are called body plans. And a body plan is a distinctive arrangement of body parts and tissues. A distinctive way of arranging stuff to make a particular kind of living form. And the Cambrian Explosion is merely one of many events in the history of life where we get a lot of new biological form, new body plans arising, in many cases, very suddenly, geologically speaking. You have arthropods, these famous trilobites. I used to love these when I was a kid. Comb jellies, the first fishes now we know arose in the Cambrian. A bivalve called a brachiopod, lots of different, very diverse ways of organizing tissues and body parts to make life. And they first arise, these animal forms, mainly first arise in this period known as the Cambrian. Now, this has posed a number of problems for modern neo-Darwinism. For one, in some seams in the rock around the world, there's a huge explosion of new biological form in a very small window of geologic time. In China, there's a seam of rock in which 16 new phyla body plans arise in about a 3 to 6 million year window. Now, that sounds like a lot of time, but given what we know about the mutation rates that are necessary to generate new genetic information, it's not very much time at all. It's a blink of an eye. So that's a problem. The other problem is that this pattern of appearance doesn't match that tree of life picture of the history of life that I was talking about a minute ago. Here's the actual pattern. You have the sudden appearance of most of these major groups with nothing anything like them in the strata beneath them. There's no ancestral precursors from which they clearly morphed, okay? There's a discrete appearance of new form. So whereas on the Darwinian view of things, you would expect a tree-like picture with lots of ancestral forms that are gradually grading into the forms that you see in the Cambrian. Instead, you have these animal forms arising very discreetly, very suddenly, geologically speaking, with nothing like them in the strata beneath. Okay? If you can see the slide, you'll see that some of these body plans I've been talking about, represented by little gold disks, and then the blue disks beneath it are what we would hope to find in the fossil record to confirm Darwin's picture of the history of life. They just haven't turned up. Now, there's complicated debates about all this, and we can talk about some of the nuances in the Q&A, but this really isn't even the question that interests me most. Like I said, I'm an information guy. I'm interested in the information problem. And I also have a father who's a mechanical engineer. And so I'm interested in questions like, what would it take to build one of those animals? There's an engineering question that's right beneath the surface when you begin to talk about biology and when you begin to talk about the Cambrian explosion. If you want to build an animal, a new animal, you've got to have, at the very least, a lot of information, a lot of instructions. You need a big instruction set in order to build the parts for that animal. Here's a way of thinking of it. When you have a new body plan arise, there's lots of different organs and tissues. Trilobites, for example, have compound lens-focusing eyes. Nothing like that in the fossil record in the entire history of life until the Cambrian. To build a new body plan, you need new organs and tissues, but you also need then new cell types. And each new type of cell for each new type of tissue has dedicated proteins. And the proteins then, in turn, require instructions for it to be built. And those instructions, at least some of those instructions, are on the DNA molecule. So the question is this: when we begin to think about the amount of information that's necessary to build these Cambrian animals, is it reasonable to think that the Darwinian process of mutation could generate the information required? See where I'm going? I'm asking an engineering question, and I'm doing so in light of the information age, because of what we know about the role of digital code, not only in our own high-tech digital computing world, but also what we now understand about the importance of digital code for living organisms. So the Darwinian view is that if you've got the DNA molecule, then you get these mutations that occur every once in a while. Those random changes in the A's, C's, G's, and T's, the nucleotide bases, the letters in the genetic alphabet, those random changes then generate new sections of code, digital code, new instruction sets, which build new proteins, which service new cell types, which are part of new organs and tissues and body plans. But it all starts with that digital information produced by the mutations. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, especially for those of you who have a computational background. One of the things that started to worry scientists, and this goes back to the late 1960s with a conference that was held at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia. It was organized by a group of MIT mathematicians and engineers and physicists who were having doubts about the mathematical plausibility of this Darwinian story. The idea that random mutations could generate any meaningful information, any functional information, certainly enough to build even one new protein. Here's what worried them. If you are going to liken the gene, the section of DNA, to digital code in a piece of software, and that is in fact a very apt comparison, both the gene and the section of digital code and software have a property called sequence specificity or functional information. There's a lot of different ways of referring to it, but you get the same stuff in both. If the information is specified, that is to say, if the arrangement of the characters matters to the function that the gene performs or the code performs, then that raises a real problem. Because what we know from all codes and languages is that when we are dealing with specificity of sequence as a condition of function, random changes degrade function or meaning much, much faster than they ever get close to coming up with something new that's useful. Okay, that's just highly intuitive. This was the intuition that led the mathematicians to begin to question the neo-Darwinian mechanism. Okay, now this was 1966. And if you want to get a little better handle on why, there's another name for this, it's called the combinatorial problem. And the basic idea is this: you're dealing with a linguistic system, and you've got choices at each site as to which letter or which 0 or 1 or which A, T, C, or G. It turns out that there's a vast number of ways of arranging all those characters, the A's, C's, G's, and T's in the gene, or the zeros and ones in software, or the letters in the English alphabet. For example, a section of English text, just 12 letters long, there are 100 trillion possible ways of arranging the 26 letters of the English alphabet. The point is, there are vastly more combinations than there are combinations that make sense. All right? Now, the mathematicians started to think, if that's also true of DNA and proteins, we're in a heap of trouble. And they began to challenge their biology colleagues to put numbers on their scenarios. How likely is it that random mutations in the DNA would actually generate new information? So that's information problem number one. Let me just quickly give you one other information problem. Turns out, if you want to build a new form of life, DNA by itself is not enough. DNA just codes for proteins. But proteins have to be arranged into distinctive cell types. The cell types have to be arranged into distinctive tissues. The distinctive tissues have to be arranged into distinctive organs. The organs and tissues have to be arranged into body plans. It turns out that the information necessary to create or generate a body plan is not entirely stored in the DNA molecule. There is another level of spatial coordinates. It is a kind of spatial information that's stored in the structure of embryos and in other places that's not stored in DNA. This also provides a lights out negative argument against the efficacy of the mutation selection mechanism. Because if the information you need to build a new animal is not entirely stored in the DNA molecule, what that means is that you can mutate DNA indefinitely without respect to time, chance, trials, probabilistic limits, and you will never build a new body plan. That's called body plan morphogenesis, is not solely under the control of DNA, and that means that the neo-Darwinian mechanism of mutating the DNA will never build a new animal form. That's a second information problem. Now, I have colleagues who address the question of tonight's talk in a completely different spirit. When they say, why are we still debating Darwin? They mean that the rigor of the technical critique of the efficacy of the mechanism is of such a high standard that we really ought to be looking for a new theory of how life began, how these animal forms began. If the mutation selection mechanism fails as an explanation for the origin of new information and new biological form, then we're back to the pre-1859 situation. We have apparent design with no undirected, unguided mechanism that can explain away that appearance and show it to be merely an illusion. In other words, the failure of the Darwinian mechanism, Darwin's designer substitute, puts the question of design back on the table. And that carries with it a whole lot of those big questions that folks at Socrates in the City like to ask.
That concludes this edition of ID the Future. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting the work of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture by going to idthefuture.com and clicking the yellow donate button. Audio from Socrates in the City was used with permission from Eric Metaxas. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.